regulatory rate-making process in a way that allows us to recover those costs, that isn't really our concern. What our concern is in a competitive area where we may be ordered to spend money, but the competitor may not be. And I can tell you that the way the facility's lease rates are set, there's no way that we can be certain of recovering costs for retrofitting facilities through the rates at which facilities are leased. And so the issue is can the regulations put one carrier at a significant disadvantage vis-a-vis another carrier? That's the issue we're trying to address.
Representative Garrett?
I could see that, and I'm not saying whether I agree or disagree. I just don't see how this doesn't relate or cause broader mischief than the goal that we're trying to reach. I could be missing it.
We'd certainly be interested in conversing with you and others about perhaps modifications to the language.
Okay, let's move through the rest of the bill, and then we'll have the bill back before us later today and tomorrow, and can have amendments or discussions at that point. Representative Garrett, to try to either eliminate it or get at what, you know, what your concerns are. We're open to whatever. So section four now, concerning depreciation rates.
Madam Chair, moving on to section four, the first paragraph of section four, which is indicated as sub K, it deals with depreciation rates. And the question here is how to set depreciation rates. We know that we've received some guidance from the Federal Communications Commission on this question. It came out in their in the press release describing the triennial review order. The triennial review order itself has not yet been published. But in the press release itself, the FCC said in competitive areas, depreciation rates should reflect the impacts of competition, the demands for new investment and innovation, and it's appropriate to provide shorter asset lives, for example, in competitive service areas than it would be in monopoly areas. And again, this is a provision which we believe is similar to what's in the Illinois statute that recently passed. This is not a matter of asking this body to adjudicate prices or adjudicate disputes, but rather it is asking this body to help set policy for the state as to where the regulators ought to go.
Representative Garrett?
Representative Vog.
Oh, pardon me, Representative Vog.
So Section K, and maybe the same thing for Section 3 or E above, and they're similar. Those apply to competitive areas?
Yes, I think, excuse me, Madam Chair, answering Representative Ogg, the intent is certainly to apply it to competitive areas, yes.
Representative Gira.
Thank you. So obviously there's an impact in allowing equipment to be depreciated in a shorter time period rather than a longer time period, and it has an impact on rates, but I don't understand what that is. So I would guess that by allowing a shorter period of depreciation, it allows, maybe under existing rules, the carrier to pass off costs to customers in a quicker, well, pass off more costs to customers, I guess. And tell me if I'm wrong about that. And then, but the question is, how does the decrease of time and depreciation rates relate to, how does that impact ACS? What does it let ACS do?
Madam Chair, responding to Representative Guerra, your concepts are in part correct, Representative Guerra, but I would take issue with some of that. The general concept is the amount of costs are the same, but it does allow for accelerated cost recovery, which means that in any 1 year, you might have more costs recovered than you would otherwise have. But I think the important issue here is what impact does this have on customers and rates? We believe that in a competitive environment, regulations have little to do with what the rates are, because the rates are really set by what the market will bear, what the competitors will allow. We have experimented, for example, with rate increases in acreage and found that we lost substantial numbers of customers. I think ACS has learned that the rates that we can charge are very directly tied to the rates that our competitor charges. It doesn't really matter what is allowed. What can happen is what the market will allow. And moreover, as we go through the legislation, there is provision here for tariff exemptions. The whole purpose of that tariff exemption section is to put into practice what I've just discussed, which is to allow the market to determine rates rather than having regulators determine rates when you have competition alive and well. So the direct answer to your question is I do not believe that increased depreciation rates or depreciation expense is likely to have any impact really on customers themselves. I do believe that this provision does have some significance, has significance to providing direction to the regulators with regards to the establishment of prices for unbundled network elements for leased facilities, and it may have some impact on intrastate access charges as well, which are also determined by the regulators.
Interestingly enough, I don't know if you ever looked at the Illinois stuff, but I mean, just interesting, we talked about Illinois because that's where it was, but almost identical language. And I mean, that's what they're asking, that's what the legislature is asking the Commerce Commission to look at, is to say that when you factor in the amount that you're going to force an incumbent to charge to competitors, or rather that they can recapture from competitors, you're going to take into account depreciation rates and fill rates and things like that. So it really has to do with the amount that you're going to be able to charge a competitor for use of your lines, of all of the different components.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
So I guess that's the question then. So how does a quicker depreciation schedule let you change your charges to other competitors?
Madam Chair, responding to Representative Guerra, it will allow us to increase the rates that we charge competitors to use our facilities. We believe that today we have been obligated to lease our facilities at artificially low rates that are below our costs. We believe this will allow us to charge rates that more accurately reflect what the facilities actually cost.
And through the chair, this begets, I mean, reduced rates, I think, to the consumer. And I guess certainly GCI may come up next and say, of course not, it's just the reverse. I mean, we can debate this all day long, but that was the hope of the subcommittee. I mean, not to be preferential, but to say what will help the consumer and be fair to businesses. Hence, you see AT&T, ATA Online, and ACS here, because that's what we chose. It wasn't a punitive thing. It was a equality thing for business, and it was consumer, I think, related. But, I mean, we could debate that, as the chair said, all day long.
I guess just
one
follow-up. You know, so is the current rule that equipment shall be depreciated based on what the RCA determines is its actual life, and the IRS rule is that equipment shall be depreciated over, I guess, what, a 7-year period or something like that? Is that right? Is that wrong?
Let me respond. Madam Chair, responding to Representative Guerra.
Mr. Steinberg, if our eating of these 100-pound Snickers disturb you, please let us know.
Madam Chair, if I see anyone getting a sugar high.
I actually brought this for everybody, too. I forgot.
Energy.
So if you prefer this, I'm going to pass it around.
I'm concerned that the committee's starting this early.
It's been a long week already.
If I may respond. I'm sorry.
That's nice.
Equal footing.
Thank you. The rules that are set today are rules that there are no specific rules, I should say, regarding how depreciation is set by the regulators. There is a tradition of how it's set, and frankly, part of the reason that we're seeking this kind of policy guidance from the legislature is that our regulators have a history of regulating monopolies, and the depreciation rates that are set for monopolies, we believe, are substantially different than what depreciation rates ought to be for competitive companies. We have recently had this issue brought to our attention in Anchorage, which is the most competitive community in Alaska, probably the most competitive community anywhere of its size in the whole country. And we had depreciation rates that were imposed on ACS of Anchorage that actually, in going from the monopoly to the competitive world, actually lengthened the service lives and decreased the depreciation expense that was allowed. We believe that was exactly the opposite direction to go when you have competition in the environment. And so we are seeking guidance from the legislature that when you have competition, you don't decrease depreciation expense, you increase depreciation expense. I don't know if that answered your question, Representative Guerra.
Representative Vaughn.
Yes, this drives back the question of cost of equipment. Sometimes you can have cost of the equipment you actually purchased. Sometimes you can have cost of the business that you purchased. And if you purchased the equipment or business in a very high expectant market where everybody was having a good time in the 1990s, somebody may have paid a lot more money than what things were worth just because of an expectation. I don't know. But how would that fit into cost appreciation?
The Madam Chair, responding to Representative Ogg, the depreciation actually goes to the book value and then essentially the net book value of the assets. You are correct that at times amounts have been paid for companies, and this was true with regards to ACS. Amounts were paid in excess of the net book value of the company. That usually shows up as goodwill on the financial statements, and that is not under current, my understanding is under current GAAP rules, that is not depreciated.
I'm not an accountant, so I don't
know.
Thank you.
Okay. Section
can I
L.
Ask one?
Oh, yes, Representative Holm.
Second part of L. You are getting to L.
Yeah,
I'm
we're
sorry.
On L,
we're
yeah.
On L. Second part of Al, when you talk about the telephone utility cancels the use, if a telephone utility cancels the use of another carrier facilities, are there contracts? I just don't understand how you work. Are there contracts between you and GCI or any other user that have provisions in them that don't allow for this reimbursement?
Madam Chair, let me respond to Representative Holm. And Representative, I apologize, but I will respond as best I can because this is a peculiar world we live in. When you ask if there are contracts usually suggest that there has been a willing buyer and a willing seller that have come together to reach an agreement about something. And that's what we usually think of as contracts. We have documents which are labeled contracts. Those documents are largely imposed on us by the regulators. Not entirely, but in large part, they are imposed on us by the regulators. So I just wanted to set the stage for what it is that we're referring to as a contract. Having said that, this is an area which has not been very well defined in some of our existing contracts, but as a practical matter, the regulators have told us that we have an obligation to construct new facilities for our competitor to serve their customers. So if GCI signs up a new customer and there's no facilities there today, we have an obligation to go out and buy and construct those facilities. Quite frankly, one of our concerns today is how do we get paid for those costs that we have incurred? Well, in theory, the way we get paid is through the rates at which we lease our facilities to the competitor. Well, there's two problems we see with that. One is today we're forced to lease those facilities at rates that are below our cost. Perhaps just as importantly, the way we get those our costs recovered is by figuring out what those costs are and then amortizing those costs over a lengthy period of time, about 20 years. Well, our primary competitor, GCI, is now telling us they intend to deploy cable telephony on their own network and move customers, migrate customers from our network to their network. So if we spend $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 constructing facilities for GCI to serve its customers on the promise that we will get repaid that investment over a 20-year period, and in 2 or 3 or 4 years, GCI takes its customer and migrates that customer onto its own network so that our facilities are no longer being used, well, we are left with a bill and no revenue to recover those costs.
Representative Holm?
No, thank you. That's what it looked like to me, so thank you very much.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So, actually, did you want to discuss L first before you took
sure,
questions?
Sure. Let me just make a couple quick comments about subsection L. And let me step back and provide some broader overview, because this is a little bit of a Rube Goldberg regulatory system we live in today. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 was passed by the Congress. It obligated carriers such as ACS to share their facilities. It had very little in it about pricing, just a very few words about pricing of those facilities. The Federal Communications Commission adopted some rules and regulations which adopted some broad guidelines for how those facilities should be priced. It said that those facilities should be based on forward-looking economic costs. It adopted a economic model, which it called the total element long-run incremental cost, otherwise known as TELRIC model. But that, all of that was within a fair amount of generality. It then delegated to the states to the job of actually implementing the pricing, having the pricing function. And what we see is that as you go through the process of taking the federal guidelines and putting them into practice, there are a number of decisions which are left to the states, a fair amount of state discretion. And it is in this area of state discretion that we feel it is appropriate for this body, the legislature, to provide some policy guidance to the regulators as to how to go about setting prices. And I will say this is exactly the same thing that happened in Illinois. It was in this area where there was state discretion that the Illinois legislature provided guidance to its commission to deal with issues such as fill factors and depreciation rates. And that's really the same kind of thing we're talking about here. There is nothing in the provisions that are in this act which are all inconsistent with, precluded, or otherwise in violation of federal law. What these provisions provide for are how to exercise state discretion in the areas which are allowed under federal law. And so the first part of L really restates what federal law says, and basically says that the a carrier shall be allowed to recover costs it expects to incur. The expects to incur language reflects that forward-looking economic cost notion that is in federal law. That's why it's written that way. We could have a debate about whether we think that's the right measure. I would suggest that's not a good use of our time. That's what the federal law says. The second question is, the second sentence goes to the issue of how do you determine what your costs are tomorrow? It's a little bit of an exercise in fiction, quite frankly. And so we believe that there's a lot of discretion there, and we think that it's appropriate for this body, which is has the power to establish policy, to provide some guidance. We think the most sensible way to determine what something is going to cost us tomorrow, whether it be our labor costs or our materials costs and so on and so forth, is to look at what the most current costs for those items are in the relevant marketplace, such as Fairbanks, and make whatever adjustments need to be made for inflation to figure out what you think that thing is going to cost tomorrow. But the place to start is, what's your most current cost for that? And that's an area which we believe that guidance is very appropriate.
And through the chair, Representative Guerra, this was the rationale behind these amendments.
Why is everybody talking to me?
Well, no, because you're asking the questions, my friend. Of course.
I didn't ask this one.
We're using you as a...
No, but that was the impetus behind whether people are opposed or supportive of this. That was the rationale, rather, and I'm sure friend Dave Harbor is online thinking, wait a minute, I need to respond, and he said this before, because he thinks that they can address these regulatory, but I think it's a statutory fix.
Thanks.
Yeah, and I think for the... through the chair. One of the things I see here is an interesting conundrum. We have the RCA, who apparently was a great part of where the problem stems from today. We're going to put the RCA back into the same role again. And I'm curious as to where the oversight, if the legislature writes statutes, where is the oversight that the legislature takes? What do we do? What do we do if RCA doesn't do what we want them to do? We write all laws in the world. What do we do? What hammer do we have over RCA?
Representative Guerra.
Representative Holm, I think the answer would be, I mean, it's a valid concern, right? I mean, we lose control over our agencies all the time, but the only thing anybody's ever figured out to do is if we write statutes, they have to follow the statutes. And if they don't, the recourse is to go to court and say, you know, we defined this as expects to incur rule. This is how we defined it. And then somebody can go to court to challenge the RCA if they don't implement that rule. The other thing would be that they could come to the legislature every single time they have a dispute, and we could do it, and that doesn't really work so well. But
I agree with you. I guess maybe it's a moot point, but I, not being an attorney, one of the few in this room that isn't, I guess, but I'm not really looking to make more lawsuits. And so I guess what my thought here was that if we're going to have something in statute that's going to regulate or ask RCA to regulate this industry, we should have some capacity to make sure that these rules and regulations are adhered to. And if they're not going to be adhered to, what's the point? Why are we going through all of this?
No, and I see what Representative Holm is saying. We had this conversation earlier today. There's been much said in arguments about just the bill itself, about whether or not, I've even heard statements, the legislature shouldn't have the ability to tinker with this. It should be a reauthorization, a clean bill of this or that. And I've said over and over again that, in fact, I disagree. I think it is absolutely this legislature's purview, not only purview, but responsibility, to analyze those commissions that we have in place, those boards, and to see whether or not they're functioning properly, whether or not we do need to change certain elements. I would only say, Representative Holm, I don't disagree with you, but I would in good faith think that if we gave them standards, I would hope that they would use them. I think the conundrum we really are in right now is that you have a situation where you have legacy telephone companies that are still considered monopolies without any current
definitely
2001 reflection on it. And so they're operating and being treated as legacies when in fact the marketplace has shifted dramatically, which is what we would expect it to do. And we don't have definitions for it. We don't have any clear definition about how it is that that incumbent carrier is supposed to recoup costs on lines that it's been asked to lease through the 96 Telecom Act. And so similar to Illinois, the legislature finally stepped in and said, we won't set the rate. It's not our job to sit around and say, well, it'll be $11.95 or $12.95 or $13.50. But what they said is, when you calculate your rate, you will consider these things. Depreciation rates, regularly recognized by the IRS, fill rates, I mean, those kinds of things. So I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I would just probably in good faith hope that if we gave them the boundaries that they would consider them. Representative Grunberg and then Guttenberg.
To respond to Representative Holm, you may recall on the floor, oh, you weren't here yesterday. There was some discussion about this. It was a circumstance where under some domestic violence laws, the court system were supposed to implement them and come out with some forms. And they didn't do it. And as a result, people had to go to court and do what's called a public interest lawsuit to get them to implement the law. And that's what you have to do.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. You know, when we were discussing this, and being one of the few non-lawyers at the table, I think the answer to that is we set up the policy, and when the board and the RCA makes a decision, they base it upon law. One of the big things, they have to justify where they're coming up to their reasoning and decision-making policy, and that's part of our system. You know, one of the problems that we're doing here is many of us don't think that they have enough guidance or too much guidance. So we change the statute, somebody appeals to them for a decision, they write that decision based upon law, state, federal law, and FERC and all those things. And if they don't follow that or it's not justifiable, then somebody takes them to court.
Yeah. Sure.
Madam Chair, if I may just respond very briefly to Representative Holm. There have been many suggestions that some of the things we're talking about here should not be discussed in the context of reauthorization. I would submit just the opposite is true, and in fact, it responds to Representative Holmes' question, what do you do to have sufficient oversight? We have a mechanism for having oversight. We have periodic reauthorizations. This is the opportunity to review what the policies of the regulators are, and therefore this is a perfectly appropriate time to try to provide direction where direction is needed.
Sure, Representative Ogg.
Yes, I was hoping to ask Dave Harper of the Commission a question, if possible.
Absolutely.
Dave Harper, I was just looking under Alaska statutes, and it appears to me under the section of general powers and duties of the Commission, and then also that's section 4205141, and then under section 4205145, which is a telecommunications regulation policy, is there language there that prohibits the RCA from adopting regulations as we're discussing here to put into statute?
Sir, through the chair, actually the RCA adopts regulations on a regular basis going through a public process that invites comment by all parties, and so that's done just all the time. It is also done within the bounds of laws that the legislature sets up or that we follow pursuant to Telecom Act or other federal legislation.
Absolutely, and follow up, Madam Chair.
Sure, Representative Ogg.
And my question was that are you prohibited, and I guess you're familiar with this draft that we're looking at, are you prohibited from making regulations similar to this presently?
Representative Ogg, through the chair, you'll understand if I don't go into much detail now. Some of the proponents of the legislation know that we're involved in some dockets, and much as Illinois' commission was concerned over legislation and when and how to speak, I'm not going to get too deeply into that, and I think you'll appreciate the reason for that. I might give you just an example. Going back to your earlier questioning, any law that the legislature passes, I think tradition has shown that the RCA is going to closely observe the statutes of the state of Alaska. I think that would be the last concern of members, that the commission would not execute the laws that are faithfully that are passed by the legislature. Our only goal, to the extent that the committees and the members wish, is that if we're asked about the impact of those, that we are obliged to carefully describe to you what we believe the impact is. If you'd like, I could give you one brief example of that. On the depreciation standards earlier discussed, you'll recall the Illinois representative saying that they have a substantial body of Illinois law that defines some of those depreciation rates, and we really don't. If this law is passed, for example, we have one little paragraph that deals with it. One of IRS's publications alone on depreciation is about 107 pages long. So in contrast, this section advocates one little depreciation rule that any rate is justified provided the life employed is no shorter than the service life permitted by the IRS. And the problem is accelerated depreciation allows the utility to set a high depreciation rate in early years, followed by a lower depreciation rate in later years. But under this proposal, the utility would not be required to set a lower rate in later years, even if the utility had substantially recovered its investment. So just to round out the answer to the question, we always will observe state statute, but to the extent that the legislature is interested in the impact of this, and we consider it to be fairly substantial impact throughout Alaska, particularly on rural Alaska, some of these provisions, we're happy to accommodate you with our counsel.
Madam Chair, I just...
Representative Ogg.
I'm just trying to get an answer here. That particular section, we'll just say that's a hypothetical, the depreciation one that's in this particular section that we're working on. If you chose, do you have the power to adopt that hypothetical thing if it presently isn't in state statutes and it's not in your regulations?
Lori Kenyon will help me on this one.
Sure.
We have authority to set in regulation pretty much anything that you have here, provided it's consistent with federal requirements. However, I think we would be challenged if we try to set into regulation that a depreciation standard should be set that may be contrary to the FCC's forward-looking economic pricing standards, as well as their just and reasonable requirements. So.
Yeah, thank you very much. You answered my question that you do have the authority to adopt depreciation as long as it doesn't violate federal law or state statute. I appreciate that conciseness.
And yet you haven't. Mr. Steinberg.
If I might just also add one point to Representative Ogg's question. None of the issues that have been brought before this committee or the legislature this year, Representative Ogg, are new. All these issues have been brought before the regulators over a period of years. There have been numerous opportunities for the commission to render decisions either in adjudicatory matters or adopt rulemakings to respond to these issues, and that has not occurred.
I appreciate your viewpoint.
Okay, we left off at Section 5, we were just getting into.
Section 5, Madam Chair, is a section that relates to tariff exemptions in competitive service areas. Again, the focus of this is really the retail tariff that consumers face. The gist of this provision is that when you have a competitive service area, we believe that the roles of the regulators should be substantially reduced. why do we say that? Well, what is the purpose of regulation? We believe that regulation serves a substantial purpose to protect consumers in monopoly environments, and it works essentially as a proxy for market forces. But where you have a substantial competition, the market forces are there alive and well. And therefore, we believe that the overburden of regulation to establish rates and prices for services is frankly unnecessary and burdensome. I would add that it really goes beyond just the theoretical. Chairman Harbor is correct that there are matters that are currently pending before the Regulatory Commission. We have today a series of rate cases to establish rates for all of the ACS companies, including ACS of Anchorage, our obviously most competitive environment. What we find there is that we have rates that are likely to be set in the year 2004 based on what happened in the year 2000. This is a proceeding which is based on year 2000 data that was commenced in 2001, and we are likely to get rates finally set in 2004. Now, in a highly competitive market where things move and change and respond to market forces, frankly, we think that there's probably going to be little relevance in 2004 of what the rates based on year 2000 test data mean. And so what we're going to end up with is a lengthy, quite burdensome process, which is likely to produce results which are likely to be of little relevance to the actual happenings of the marketplace. Mind you, this is costly. Eventually, those costs are costs which have to be passed on to consumers. We think that consumers are better off allowing market forces to work to protect them and to provide correct rates. Clearly, we have found out, ACS has found out, that we are not in a position to raise rates and not suffer any consequences. We have found out that customers have the opportunity and do go to the other guy or other guys when they find our service or our rates unacceptable. We think that really accounts for appropriate consumer choice, and an overburden of regulation just is no longer appropriate in those competitive areas.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I missed the end of subsection L on page 4, and I just have a question about what existing law is, what we're trying to change. So, in section 4, subsection L, the proposal is to change the definition of costs it expects to incur to be based on the most current costs adjusted for inflation. How is that defined right now?
Madam Chair, responding to Representative Guerra, one of the reasons we believe it's, there are several reasons we believe it's appropriate for the legislature to address these issues, Representative Guerra. In fact, there are no specific definitions for these items today. You can find some actions by the regulators in various decisions, but this is an area in which there has been discretion has been granted to the states, and in fact is being exercised by the regulators. With all due respect to our regulatory commission, we do believe that when it comes to matters of important state policy, it is you, our elected representatives, who are better situated to adopt state policy than our appointed regulators. And so there really is nothing in either statute or regulation today regarding these matters, and it has been left to the regulators' discretion.
But,
Representative Kerr? Thank you.
So I know the RCA sometimes regulates by regulations, sometimes they regulate by rules they adopt in decisions, but I take it if they've adopted a rule in a decision, they don't change it every time. Maybe I'm wrong, but is there a rule in a decision that they have adopted that defines what expects to incur is? Is there a standard they've adopted by decision?
I'm hesitating only to try to find a simple way to get into this area that can be rather technical and complex, Madam Chair. An excellent example, if you will, is the set of decisions which occurred in the rate setting concerning our rates for the Fairbanks area. ACS's cost of providing a service of a local loop, a line, that connection between the network interface device and the central office, is in the neighborhood of between $30 and $34, depending on how you measure it. ACS calculated a forward-looking cost for that loop, let me explain that $30 to $34 is our actual cost. What do I mean by actual cost? I mean, this is what the kind of number we put on our financial statements. This is what we would be dragged into jail on if it was the wrong number, that kind of actual cost. But under the FCC's rules, we're required to lease these facilities on the basis of a fictional forward-looking cost. We calculated what that forward-looking cost was, and we came up with a number of about $36. However, when the regulators set our rates for Fairbanks, they obligated us to sell those facilities, to lease those facilities, for about $19. Now, how did we get from $30 to $36 down to $19? Well, it's a complicated answer. We believe there were several things that we think were improper policy calls made by the regulators. We believe they adopted an economic model that the FCC had developed for a different purpose and specifically said don't use for this purpose. We think it was an improper policy call to go ahead and do it anyhow. They also adopted various national average default cost inputs as the starting basis for how to determine what our costs are. What does that mean, national average default cost inputs? Well, in essence, if you will, and this is a simplification, but in essence, what that means is the prices that we are allowed to charge for leasing our facilities in Fairbanks are based on somebody else's costs in Atlanta or Dallas or Omaha or wherever they got those national average default numbers from. And we believe that's inappropriate and not the right policy call.
So that's what they did. They came up with some average cost.
Yes, and to be fair, the regulators said they were going to make some adjustments to reflect the Alaskan cost element related to that, but we feel that those adjustments were wholly inadequate, and essentially we got saddled with costs from someplace in the lower 48, completely irrelevant to what the cost structures are for a company like ours in a place like Fairbanks.
Thank you.
So on Section 5,
Madam Chair,
yes.
I hate to slow things down. I know that we want to do this quickly, but I do have a question on the second part of L, which really stands out, and that's the if you cancel. Okay. Mr. Steinberg, the second part of L deals with what happens when you, I guess, as a competitive carrier, start using the existing carrier's equipment, and then you withdraw from the market because, let's say, it's not working out for you. And then it says if you do that, you've got to pay the existing carrier, the balance of the capital expenditures incurred by the other carrier as a result of the cancellation. So I start using your phone lines, I decide I can't make a go of it as a business. What do I have to, what's the penalty? Do I have to pay you for the some portion of the cost of those phone lines, even though they were there already? Or do I just have to pay you for things that you did for me because I came in and you had to do things for me to let me use your phone lines?
Madam Chair, let me respond to Representative Guerin. I don't know, you may have stepped out of the room when I was responding to a similar question by Representative Holm on this section. This is a charge that would go to a competing carrier, not a customer.
Yeah,
and
I understand that.
And the the real issue here is, and I think there are some improvements that could be made on this language. As people know, this Labor and Commerce Committee draft was a few weeks ago, and we've had some chance to look at it and have some ideas about improvements. But the general notion is, how do you, today ACS is required to go construct new facilities for competitors, including our colleagues at GCI, to serve their customers. And sometimes those facilities may cost us $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 or more to serve a single customer. Well, how do we recover those costs? Well, in theory, we recover those costs through the rates at which we lease our facilities. Again, we have an issue with that today. But in theory, not only do we recover through those lease rates, but it's over time. The costs are amortized over a period of 20 years. What we know today is that our chief competitor, GCI, has publicly said they intend to develop their own network of cable telephony and that they intend to migrate their customers off of our network onto their network. So if we spend $20,000 to construct some facilities for GCI to serve its customers, and in 3 or 4 or 5 years, GCI takes that customer off of our network and onto its own network, then we have essentially 15 years of unrecovered costs, and we are left holding the bill for facilities or for construction costs that we incurred for them to serve their customers. We don't think that's right.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on this?
Sure.
That sounds logical, but here's, I just want to make sure that this thing is narrowly drawn. If you go and you construct stuff for GCI and then they leave and you're left holding the bag, that seems unfair to me. But if you were going, if you went and you upgraded your lines because you were going to do it and GCI happened to benefit from that, you know, you've got lines, they're not good enough, GCI is now using your lines, and you guys decide, well, shoot, we want to use better lines for whatever. And I keep using lines because I know nothing about telephones, and that's the only thing I understand, that there are lines all over the place. So so you decide you want better lines. Except GCI leaves. You've upgraded them. Can you charge those costs to GCI? Like, are you charging, would this enable you to charge those the costs to GCI, just the ones you incurred because of GCI? Or will this now let you charge, when they leave, charge costs that you were going to incur anyway? That's the part.
Madam Chair, responding to Representative Guerra as quickly as I can. Again, this is something that was in this the draft that came out of the committee substitute out of Labor and Commerce. We do think there are ways to improve the language. I think I've articulated what the objective was, and without taking too much time here, we do believe that there are ways to improve the specific wording to achieve that objective.
So the concept that I mentioned, that's what you're trying to get at, but this doesn't get at it, is that?
We think that this language can be improved upon, yes.
Is that a yes?
Well, we think that, Madam Chair, if I may just go on.
Yeah, you can. And Representative Guerra, what we did, there were some improvements that had been made, and we had a judiciary CS drafted, but it was my feeling that we ought to start with the version of this bill that has been the most widely disseminated, the most widely debated by the public, and considered in a subcommittee, in fact, of one of this legislature standing committees. So while there were some improvements that I would like to see, I had decided that maybe we should get them in the form of amendments instead, just so that everybody's clear about what the version is. I don't want anyone to feel like there are too many versions floating around and that they're snowed into something. So that's the reason that you have it before you. And there will be areas, I think, that we can make some more improvements.
I appreciate it. And I know you didn't mean to sort of adopt this whole scale, and I just want to make sure I understand it, that's all.
Representative Holm.
Yeah, to the point, I see the reverse possibility, too, and I don't see it addressed here. And that would be, you decided to upgrade without informing GCI. And so obviously they would incur costs that they would have no possibility of ever charging their customers. Wherein does that fit into this?
Madam Chair, responding to Representative Holm, If I understand your question correctly, let me restate.
I'm not sure I phrased it right, but.
Yes. Let me respond this way. The prices at which we can lease our facilities to our competitor are based on a fiction. They are based on forward-looking economic costs, assuming a hypothetical network. It has absolutely nothing to do with what our actual costs are. And so if we go and if ACS goes and upgrades its facilities and incurs a bunch of costs as a result, there is no mechanism through the federal regulations, the federal rules on how to set prices for lease facilities that would allow ACS to pass through those costs to a competitor. Does that answer your question?
Madam Chair, well, a slight follow-up here then. Okay, I didn't really quite realize that it was that nebulous of an area. But assuming that somehow it gets hammered down here or tightened up, there still is a reverse possibility, is there not, that ACS, for whatever reason, decides to spend millions of dollars and shoot up a satellite or whatever you do, and you have incurred these. There's no mechanism whereby you can go back. What you're telling me is there's no mechanism whereby you can go back to RCA or FERC or somebody, whoever it would be, and say, we need an increase or we demand an increase. There's no relationship between your costs, is what you're saying on the record. There's no relationship in reality between your costs and what you charge.
As hard as it is to believe that American businesses run that way, the answer is yes, Representative Holm. Excuse me, Madam Chair. The way the rules are established are the rates at which we can lease our facilities have little to do with what our actual costs are. That's one of the problems that we have with this whole mechanism. We have no ability to really recover costs that we spend under today's set of rules. It's a very different world from monopoly regulation. We are expected to lease our facilities based on rates that would occur in the future for a hypothetically efficient network. We don't think that's the right measure, quite frankly, but that's a federal law and we are obligated to comply with it. Everything in the proposals that are before you are fully consistent with that those provisions of federal law. And just to add, Representative Holm, the reality is that today ACS won't spend millions of dollars putting up a satellite or doing much of anything else, precisely because the rates at which we have to lease our facilities are so low, we have no incentive to go out and make any investments because we can't recover our costs.
Thank you, Mr. Senator.
Senator Samuels. Oh, no. Pardon me. Representative Holm, continue.
No, I'm just incredulous. I'm amazed. I'm amazed that we don't have a system that takes into consideration that if a company puts, it would be like me, I'm in the greenhouse business, I have to take it back to the manure business, I guess, but it would be like me growing tomato plants in my greenhouse and having to somehow sell tomato plants to your greenhouse and not be able to sell the plants.
That's exactly right, Representative Holm.
I don't get it.
Well, excuse me, Madam Chair, but frankly, we don't get it either. We don't think that these policies provide a long-term future for telecommunications in Alaska. That is exactly why we are here. We believe that there have been some short-term benefits. Have consumers had rates kept low? Absolutely. But what does it do to investment for the future? If you were having to sell your tomato plants at a loss to your competitor, I suspect you wouldn't invest in tomato plants for much longer.
That's my point.
Sure, that's a good segue because I know we're short of time.
No, actually, we've got to five.
So close to
Samuels, and then.
Sure.
Sorry.
Representative Samuels. Okay.
We have a brief Eddies.
We'll have a brief Eddies.
My question.
Gotten through Section 4 with ACS. Now we're going to go through Section 4 with one representative from GCI. And mind you, I'm doing the same thing to ACS. I know you all have people down here in droves, and I'm going to have one person speak for each of you. ACS has elected Mr. Steinberg to speak. GCI select who you would like to speak, and you will have equal time to go through sections 1 through 4. And then we'll come back and continue on from there. Ms. Tyndall.
Thank
Did you draw the short straw?
For the record, my name is Dana Tindall. I'm Senior Vice President for Legal and Regulatory Affairs. And like ACS, I have someone online who is similar in position to the staff person from Illinois, and that is Chris Wright, former general counsel of the FCC. And he will be available to answer questions as well. May I confirm that Chris is on the line?
Yeah, you can, because I'm not seeing that.
Chris, are you on the line? He was supposed to be on the line. Well.
But is it your, Dana, is it your intent to walk through the bill the way that Mr. Steinberg did, or is it your intent that the person online, Chris, will?
It is my intent to walk through the bill with questions of an expert nature. He can answer questions on what the FCC has done as well as what the Illinois legislation.
Okay, so, and again, I'm trying to do equal time and do this fair. So the reason I ask is that Greg Boyd is on the line.
Yes.
As well, another attorney for the other side. And what I was trying to do is, at least for now, why don't you just do your, Chris isn't on the line anyway, but why don't you walk through the bill the same way?
Sorry, I am on the line. I stepped out for just 2 minutes. You are. Okay. I must have stepped out at exactly the wrong time.
Okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, to be fair, ACS had an expert from the Illinois staff online.
Oh, no, I called Dana. Dana, that was my idea. I looked around and said, like I always do on every hearing here, what are the other states doing? My staff, Heath Hilliard, called that individual to come in. And ironically, that testimony could have gone either way because that individual is actually in the Regulatory Commission. And so that was my doing. It was not ACS's doing. In fact, they had no knowledge of it.
Madam Chair, for the record, Mr. Wright is the former general counsel of the FCC.
And so will you be going through the bill or will he?
I will be going through the bill.
Fantastic.
I would like him available to answer questions.
Section 1.
Section 1 is findings. Like Mr. Steinberg, I won't spend a lot of time on this, except to point out that the findings on their face are inconsistent within themselves when you take them all together. They seem to take up the notion that regulation is somehow holding competition back and investment. The regulator's position is to regulate to the extent that markets fail. In a perfect competition market scenario, you don't need a regulator because you have perfect competition. You have perfect information. You have free market flow. You have no barriers. You have, by definition, perfect competition. No one is able to control prices. In a monopoly market, that's not true. You don't have competition, and so you have regulation, which is supposed to take the place of competition. In an emerging competitive market, which is what we have here, we have regulation to the extent that there still remains market power. And make no mistake, because the local telephone company, ACS, or any other one you want to pick around the state, still controls the network, and the only line to the customer's home, the local telephone company continues to have market power, and that needs to be regulated. In addition, once you start having regulation, or once you start having competition, and you go from a monopoly market to emerging competitive market, the regulator uses competition as a tool to help keep rates down and encourage incentives for investment. You no longer have to step in and tell the company what to do, but you do have to ensure that competition is viable. The regulation that we have at the RCA is necessary to continue to ensure that competition is viable and that there is still fairness because the incumbent local telephone company continues to have market power. So I disagree with the notion that any regulation in these markets must be holding markets back. That's simply not true. And that there are other inconsistencies within the face of the findings that I will go into if there are any questions. Section 2.
Madam Chair.
Representative Holm.
Just on that point, I was interested, Ms. Dendell, you said, if I heard you correctly, that the RCA oversight or the management of the competitive nature between a monopolistic environment or an emerging market as we have here encourages, if I can quote you here, you said it encourages incentives for investment. Can you expand on that? Investment by whom? We just had testimony here that said ACS was not encouraged to invest because of their hands being tied in terms of rates.
Through the chair. Yes, that's what I said. ACS, as a monopolist, was encouraged to invest because it earned a rate of return on its plant in the ground. For every dollar it spent, it got that back plus a rate of return. This included to not only invest, but to invest heavily in facilities and plant. When you move to a competitive market, the incumbent is encouraged to invest through competitive forces to keep up, to provide a decent level of service. ACS would like to continue to go with the rate of return or have regulatory certainty. The Regulatory Commission, the FCC, and the Congress focus, his entire focus, has been on encouraging competitive carriers to invest by pricing the network that the incumbent carrier leases to competitive carriers at forward-looking, long-run incremental costs. What that means is that the prices that a competitor faces coming into a market when it leases unbundled elements from the existing carrier are supposed to be similar to the prices that a competitor would face if it were building its own network from scratch with the most modern technology and with the incentive to have the lowest cost possible. Rather than paying for a monopoly network that was built with incentives to have the highest cost possible. So if priced correctly, unbundled elements will make a competitive entrant indifferent between building their own network and staying on the incumbent's network. Now, this was a safeguard, frankly, to protect incumbents. I'm sure that the FCC would have actually, or Congress would have actually liked them to encourage them to build a little more, but if a competitor comes in and takes customers away from the incumbent carrier, ACS in this example, and builds its own network, ACS will be getting no revenue for those lines. So they want it as an economic principle, as an economic matter. They wanted a competitive entrant to be indifferent between building their own network and leasing the competitors. And the purpose of this was to jumpstart competition. Congress determined that competition in local telephone service was in the consumer's best interest, that it was the best way to bring new technology and advanced service and lowest cost to the consumer. They didn't determine we're going to hold back benefits to the consumers because we have to ensure monopoly companies price margins. And the reason they didn't determine that is because the monopoly companies built their network in the public interest. They were guaranteed a monopoly. They were guaranteed a rate of return so that consumers could get served. They had their opportunity, and they were given a monopoly, a legal monopoly. People were not allowed to go in and compete with them. In those days, that was determined to be in the consumer's best interest. Now, Congress has determined that competition is in the consumer's interest, and Congress has determined that it is fair to require the monopoly companies to lease out their networks because they built those networks and had those networks paid for through a guaranteed rate of return in a monopoly system. That's a long answer, but
good. Thank you.
I guess I would just, and that's kind of what I wanted to hear. I was curious as to how we got here from there.
That's the way it happened.
Ms. Tindall, do you believe the ACS, I mean, I understand the original, when I worked for Senator Stevens, we worked on the Telecommunications Act of 96. It was leading up to that. And I remember all of those goals, and I think they're really good goals. Benefiting the consumer, interjecting competition into a marketplace that hadn't been there. And I think that it's fair to say that when ATU, when that act passed and ATU was in place, that they were a monopoly. My question to you now is, now that you know that I agree with the goals of it, and I agree with even the mechanisms that were put in place to achieve competition, do you still believe that ACS is a monopoly?
I believe that ACS in the Anchorage market has market power over the network that competitors have to use, both local telephone companies and long-distance competitors. And because I believe that they have monopoly power, 100% monopoly power over that network, that should be regulated. The RCA is involved in a proceeding to deregulate the local telephone market where there's competition. GCI has filed a pleading proposing that the market be looked at in two segments. One, in the retail market, where it's end user rates, that where an incumbent carrier has less than a 60% of the market, that the incumbent carrier be deregulated for the purpose of retail rates. Free to charge whatever rates they want, free to bundle, free to do whatever they want. And by the way, the RCA does have regulations where an incumbent dominant carrier can come in and be deregulated as a non-dominant carrier, the same as Illinois. GCI in the I'm going to call it the network element market, which is a separate market because ACS has control over a bottleneck facility, has proposed in the Anchorage market, for example, if a competitive carrier has greater than 35% of the retail market, that they should be required to contribute to building out a network, or they should be required to build out pieces of their own network to reach new customers. In a market we have proposed where there is a carrier, where there is a competitive carrier that has more than a 35% market share, which we do in Anchorage, we are proposing that we share carrier of last resort responsibilities. That's Anchorage. And that's, we're proposing that wherever a market reaches those standards. ACS has many, many, many markets. I think I counted over 30 communities and villages. Actually, there were 56 communities and villages in telephone utilities of the Northland, which is all one service area, where there is no competition. When you deregulate ACS, you deregulate them for all of those communities where there is no competition. So, yes, I believe ACS has market power in the Anchorage unbundled element market. I don't believe they have monopoly power in the retail market. I believe they have monopoly power throughout the rest of their some 90 communities and villages.
Okay, and then, so you're, Representative Anderson just slipped me these percentages. I just want to make sure if they're correct or not. So the market shares are in the long distance area. It looks like ACS has 10%, AT&T has 37%, GCI has 43%. Is that correct?
Yes.
So 10% to 43. And then...
With your permission.
Sure.
The long distance market is a separate market from the local market.
And then in the local market, AT&T has 6%, GCI has 44%, and ACS has 50%. That's correct?
GCI has, in Anchorage, 45% of the local market. Statewide, we have 20% of the market. And in answer to Representative Guerra's question, there is no telephone company that has greater than a 60% statewide market share.
So we were section
two. Okay. Section 2, from our perspective, there is one difference between dominant carrier regulation and non-dominant carrier regulation in the RCA's regulation. That single and sole difference is the ability to raise rates. Currently, if you are regulated as a dominant carrier, in order to raise rates, you have to come into the RCA and get permission to raise rates. If you are regulated, you're free to lower rates all you want. If you are regulated as a non-dominant carrier, you may raise and lower rates as you will because it is presumed you do not have market power. There is a definition for a dominant carrier. It is in regulation. It is by how much market power they have. Section 2 would take ACS, example, Telephone Utilities of the Northland. The minute competition is approved and before it's rolled out, before a competitor serves the first customer and deregulates, Section 2 deregulates the incumbent local telephone company for the entire service area. In Telephone Utilities of the Northland, that would be actually, I have to get kind of crafty about the way they published it.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Guerra. When you talk about dominant, today dominance must ask permission to raise rates, you're talking about consumer rates or you're talking about rates to other companies for using equipment?
Retail rates. I'm sorry. Consumer retail rates. Telephone Utilities of the Northland serves Accioch, Accutan, Allakaket, Angoon, Atka, Border City, Chignik, Chignik Lagoon. There's 56 of them here, all the way down to Yakutat. And Telephone Utilities of the Northland, the minute competition was approved in Kenai, would be deregulated to raise rates to all of these communities and villages without RCA oversight whatsoever. That's what Section 2 does. And it does it for every telephone utility, by the way, because there are no telephone utilities that have less than a 60% market share. So since there is no difference between dominant carrier regulation and non-dominant carrier regulation, other than the ability to raise rates, I have to assume that the purpose of Section 2 is so that the local telephone companies throughout the state may raise their rates. Section 3. Section 3 says that any rule, regulation that's not on the books now, that's adopted after this passes, cannot apply retroactively. I believe that this regulation stems from a rule that the RCA passed ordering, well, the state telecommunication management plan that was passed some years ago by the TIF required all of the local telephone company utilities to bring their networks up to a standard that would transmit 28.8 data transmissions. They said that they were not able to meet that standard. The RCA, at the time the APC, gave them time to bring their networks up to that standard. They still haven't brought their networks up to that standard. I believe the purpose of this regulation is to let them out of that, bringing their networks up to that standard. I also believe that this regulation, since there are no regulations on the book regarding carrier of last resort and requirements to extend services to new neighborhoods, that this regulation could be used so that carriers don't have to continue extending their network to provide service. That's the purpose of this regulation. Section 4. Section 4 deals with proposed depreciation rates. I think the background of this section is that ACS bought in the year 2000 the telephone companies, Telephone Utilities of the Northland, Telephone Utilities of Alaska, Fairbanks Municipal Telephone Systems, and Anchorage Telephone Utility. And these were the telephone companies in Juneau, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Sitka, and all over. By the way, they purchased these companies after competition had been permitted, and there was competition. As a requirement of their purchase of these companies, the RCA said that they had to come in for a rate case. They were going to be regulated as a non-dominant carrier, had to set the rates the right place before you could let them start lowering them. They're going to be regulated such that they were free to lower rates. So they wanted the company to come in and set its rate. ACS agreed. ACS, when it went in for its rate case, asked, I believe, for a $63 million rate increase across all of its local telephone companies as a whole. All of the issues in that case settled out except for the depreciation issue. Through discovery, it turns out that ACS has been over-depreciating its plant and equipment, and so had its previous owners. ACS has, in fact, been over-earning. And because it has over-depreciated its plant and equipment, there is very little money left on the books for this plant and equipment, although there is quite a bit of lives. When the RCA set the FCC lives for this plant and equipment, and they put in, as a mathematical equation, how much the equipment was already amortized, the depreciation rates that fell out were quite low and would, in fact, force ACS to decrease rates. ACS has, this order came out quite a while ago. ACS has asked the commission to reconsider several times, which is why we are now in the second year of this rate case, and why we are still using 2000-year test data. And the commission has yet to do a final ruling. The original purpose of this section is to circumvent a commission ruling requiring ACS to lower their rates. However, it has the collateral damage of allowing all local telephone companies to increase their rates statewide. We estimate it to be about $100 million overnight. If anybody is interested, I have the per company, per line, per month amounts. The IRS depreciation amounts are for companies that are not rate-based regulated. They are simply a tax mechanism. How much do you get to write off? If you are a rate-based regulated company and you have this huge network, the depreciation rate determines how much of that network you get to charge your consumers.
Representative Kerr.
Just so I can keep up with you. If assuming ACS has depreciated a very substantial portion of this existing equipment, regardless of whether they did it too quickly or not too quickly, the point I gather is that they've depreciated a very huge portion of this equipment already, then does this section let them re-depreciate stuff they've already benefited from? Or am I correct in assuming that if they've already depreciated so much, there's very little for them to depreciate anyway, so why should we worry about that? By over-depreciating in the past, aren't we going to now benefit from lower rates because there's very little for them to depreciate anymore?
We were setting rate. I'm sorry, through the chair.
Tell me if my understanding is at all correct, and see what you can answer.
If we were setting rates every year, then that would be true. You know, we would, every year we'd say, okay, you get this little bit more, this little bit more, and this little more, and pretty soon you fall off the cliff and there's nothing to depreciate and rates drop, right? But that's not what we're doing. We're setting rates, the RCA is setting rates for ACS on a one-time basis. These rates are never going to be set again, okay? And so ACS from that point is free to lower their rates, but may have to come in for a rate case if they want to increase their rates. It's in ACS's interest on this one-time rate setting only to get those rates as high as they can. And so it does matter. It is the starting point where you start. And remember, there's only competition in Anchorage. There is no competitive forces that would stop, that would affect a rate increase anywhere else. Does that answer your question? I'm sorry.
I don't think I understand it.
Is that just, Kara.
Are there other, if everybody else understands it, then.
No, I think you're going in the right direction. Keep going.
Okay. So, because I don't understand it, I'm still stuck where I was before. And I guess in part it's due to the sort of artificial thing of that there's not an ongoing depreciation, an ongoing assessment of the depreciation, and an ongoing change of the rates by RCA. But what is the, you're talking about this one-time rate setting. What is this one-time, first question is, what is this one-time rate setting? Is it going on right now? And then how is it that if ACS has previously done all this depreciation, that it should even matter to us if that's been done in the past already, and the RCA really should only be considering its future or current depreciation? I think I'm wrong in those questions, but I don't understand the relationship between what they've depreciated in the past, the one rate setting you're talking about now, and why that one rate setting is going to be set in stone in the future to impact us. And I'm wondering why, if they've over-depreciated in the past, and I don't, I'm not saying I believe that, I'm not saying one way or the other I agree that they've over-depreciated. I'll never know, and I'm never going to look into it. But why am I not right in wondering if they've over-depreciated in the past that the consumers might benefit because there's very little to depreciate left?
If I could help supplement that, maybe you could explain to the committee, and I don't have great expertise in it either, your relationship to ACS in terms of leasing. I mean, because GCI leases from ACS, correct?
Yes.
And isn't it cheaper for you to lease from ACS than to build your own?
To Representative Garris.
Well, it's an open conversation. We all ask questions, and yes, you can
they're two different
respond
issues.
To his, that's and fair. Then you can respond to his, but it's not inappropriate. This is the Judiciary Committee. We are a bunch of people that ask a lot of questions, so
that's fine.
Don't be offended. Representative Guerra.
Okay, let me take a crack at it, okay?
And do it slow, because this is, okay. I understand very little about this.
ACS is over-depreciated, and the consumers should benefit by lower rates. And so when you go in and you figure out, they're in a rate case right now, and you go in and you figure out how much plant's left and how much should be depreciated in remaining years, it's a very small amount, okay? So that would drive rates down from where they are. That is the effect of the Commission's decision on the depreciation rate. What Section 3 would do would enable companies, ACS and other companies, to charge whatever depreciation rate they want up to the IRS guidelines, which are quite a bit higher. I think that the Commission overall composite depreciation rate came out to something like 3.4%. It was really low because of the fact that the plant was so over-depreciated, which would drive rates down. Consumers would benefit. And there would have to be a rate decrease. But under Section 3, or I'm sorry, Section 4, companies could come in and charge a much higher depreciation rate, which would drive rates up. ACS had, ATU and the other companies had their rates last set by the APUC, and now since they bought the companies, they're in a rate case again. They're setting those rates right now. That depreciation rate is the rate that will determine their retail rate benchmark from now on.
Just if I could interject, one thing that I think is interesting, though, you said in your testimony that you thought that the main purpose of this thing, of Section K, was to get them out of, to be able to assess higher rates because of a past act. And then you talked about the future and the potential for higher rates. What I think is so interesting is this gentleman that I found in Illinois says the exact opposite. He's a member of the Illinois Commerce Commission. And in fact, it was his testimony, not knowing anything about ACS or GCI or any rate case dispute that might be at hand, that in fact the depreciation rates and the fill rates guidelines were put into place on the part of that legislature specifically to allow for ultimate benefits to the consumer, better.
Representative McGuire, it's my understanding that whatever effects there are in the Illinois legislation apply to uni rates that competitors lease from the incumbent carrier, not the retail rates that's charged to the consumers.
Right.
What this does is allow telephone utilities to raise the retail rates that are charged to consumers. This doesn't deal with the rates that are being charged by one company to another company.
I was looking at notes from an earlier meeting. FCC provides guidelines, and I'm going to ask you to confirm this or not. FCC provides guidelines on pricing the facilities. And the RCA sets the actual monetary amount, and those guidelines that the RCA utilizes are discretionary. This is my read on this. Because state policy, I guess we're trying to set state policy, but in my opinion, there's a mature market in Anchorage. So why would there be special privileges talking about this depreciation when the company sizes are so relative? I mean, that's what I think with Representative McGuire and myself are getting at. And I think Representative Guerra is kind of on the periphery of it. But, and I know we don't want to debate back and forth.
Right. Again, Representative Anderson, this section deals with consumer rates. It doesn't deal with the unbundled element or the leasing rates that GCI pays to ACS. If this section just dealt with Anchorage alone, it might be fine. But it doesn't just deal with Anchorage alone. It deals with all local telephone companies throughout the state. And there is only, and I agree, the Anchorage market is competitive. And actually, if ACS doesn't file their petition for deregulation soon, I'm going to file it for them. But outside of Anchorage, this would allow companies where there's not competition to increase retail rates.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to take a scoot around here a little bit because I'm trying to get my handle on something here because I'm slow.
I'm slower.
And I don't know about that.
Slowest.
And this has to do with a business question, which has nothing to maybe to do with your particular circumstance, but it certainly tries to give me a handle on what you're trying to get to here. If I raise the depreciation on my assets, it has two things that happen for me. It allows me a better tax position, and it lowers my profitability. Now, if I'm a publicly held company, the lower my profit, the less my stock looks attractive. So it has some downsides to it. Conversely, if my depreciation rates go down, it raises my taxes, but it also raises my profitability. So it improves my bottom line. Now, what I'm trying to get a handle on here is not handling the consumer question, because a consumer question in this particular relationship really doesn't fit with me. It fits with the RCA part of this, and I know that's what we're dealing with here. But I'm trying to get a handle on the disparity between the person who puts the investment, and in this case, I assume it's ACS put the investment in originally. Is that not true?
Well, they bought the company.
Well, right. They bought it with cash. They bought it with something. Whatever they bought it with assets. Somebody's assets, but they're now called ACS. And I'm going back to my tomato plant business because I can't do any more than this. I've got a greenhouse, and I built it with my hammer and whatever, and I do all the work myself, and I build this place. And I'm trying to get whether or not I depreciate it quickly or in a long term really has no bearing on whether or not it's profitable to me as a company. Okay, if we can start there, because I'm really trying to get a handle on this. It is mine. I own it.
Correct.
The person I contract with only owns it based upon the reality of those contracts.
In other words, if I leased it out to Walmart to grow tomato plants for them, I would take into consideration my asset costs, my depreciation, and so forth and so on, and my desired profitability. And I would set my prices based on that.
Right.
In this case, we have considered a monopoly which says that they somehow have been charging too much already, theoretically, and because they're a monopoly and the marketplace is not free to work as a free market, the RCA then can set rates. So the argument here, as I see in all of this, and I think Section 4 is as good a one as any to look at, is whether or not the RCA is acting in the consumer's best interest and participating with the owner of the facility and those they've contracted with. What I have a problem with is how do we set policy, state policy, whether it's this or what it is, that protects both the consumer, since we have to deal with it in a monopolistic sense, it's an emerging market as we're talking about here, and is fair and appropriate to the person who has gambled their assets. And that's where I'm having trouble, is the gambling of the assets by the original owner. Not to say you aren't gambling your assets as well. You know, I'm having trouble weighing, you know, who's who in this game. Help me.
To respond to your tomato business example.
Okay.
I agree with everything you said. Now, if the government had come to you instead, in an alternate universe, and said, Representative Holm, you're a good guy. You're such a good guy, we're going to let you be the only tomato grower in the state of Alaska. We're not going to allow anybody else to grow tomatoes in the state of Alaska. And we're not going to let anybody import tomatoes from the lower 48. You, Representative Holm, are going to be our only source of tomato. And you say, all right, I'm going to charge $100 a tomato. Those tomatoes are going to be gold-plated tomatoes. And they say, no. Representative Holm, this is what you get to charge. You get to charge, you have this field where you're growing your tomatoes. You have all of this plant, literally, you put in the ground for your tomatoes. We're going to pay for all that. Plus a rate of return. You know, we're going to pay all your expenses. We're going to take this field and this plant and your tomatoes, and we're going to let you charge a portion of it for each tomato. We're going to let you allocate a portion of that field, portion of that dirt, portion of for each tomato you charge, plus a rate of return. We're not going to let you charge the first customer who comes along for your entire 50 acres of tomatoes. They don't have to pay $50,000 for that tomato, for that first tomato, okay? This is what we're going to allow you to charge. We're going to let you allocate, depreciate that. And that how much you get to depreciate and allocate that dirt is what you're going to charge for each tomato. And we have to set that charge because there's no competitive forces. You don't have anyone competing with you. But this is a deal for you because we're not going to allow anyone else to sell to you. So what you get to, how much you get to allocate of that dirt patch is real important to what rate you get to charge people. But you're guaranteed. You're guaranteed a rate of return. You are guaranteed a profit. Okay? So this goes on for a period of years. Right? Period of years. Finally, someone comes up with a bigger and better tomato. And it turns out that if the people who eat tomatoes don't get access to this bigger and better tomato, they're not going to be as well off. And so, you know, by now you've got tomato fields across the state. You have every consumer who eats tomatoes, you know them by name. You have their billing address. You send them mailings. You send them Christmas cards. You send their wives flowers. You know them. They're yours. They're your customers. We're going to allow this competitor to grow a tomato plant to try out his new advanced tomato. But he has to have access to your dirt because you've taken up all the dirt. in the state. So we're going to let him have access to your dirt. And you say, all right, he gets one plant. I'm going to charge him $50,000 for that little square inch of dirt. And I know all the customers. The customers are all mine starting day one. And they say, no, 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 no. Representative Holm, that's not fair. You have market power because you have all the customers from day one. You have 100% of the customers from day one. We're going to tell you how much you get to charge that competitor because we let you have that monopoly for so long. And you say, well, that's not fair. If competition gets a foothold, I won't make as much money. I won't have those guaranteed profits. So why don't we do this? The minute you say another grower can grow a tomato in the state of Alaska, then I get to charge whatever rate I want. I could drive my rates down, I could drive my rates up, because they're only in this little square part of Anchorage. The tomato grower, the new tomato grower is only in Anchorage. I can lower my rates there, and I can raise my rates in Kodiak and make up the difference. That's what we're talking about. That's why if you're a competitive company, you don't have a monopoly, your rates are set by competitive forces, the depreciation is for tax purposes only. That's why the IRS guidelines are as high as they are. You can make the choices you want. If you have a monopoly where you are guaranteed to get a rate of return, where you have all the customers from day one, and you were given that by the government, then depreciation serves a very different purpose because there are no competitive forces setting rates.
So,
the record, Chairman McGuire had to step out, so I'll be chairing until she comes back.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Just to follow up, then, and so you're intimating then, or you're saying that in this particular environment, that it still carries, by saying it's a market power, it still carries a monopolistic bearing, I guess.
Market power is monopoly power. The two are interchangeable.
You're saying
there
today it is
that way. Yes. ACS today has market power everywhere outside of Anchorage. In many of these.
But let me stop you there just for a second. Anchorage is so much, it's a huge part of the market, I suspect, in the total market in the state of Alaska. So.
Not Kodiak.
No.
In Kodiak, there is no competition. ACS would be free to raise their rates in Kodiak, and consumers would have no choice. ACS did raise their rates in 24% in Anchorage. GCI did not follow them up, and overnight we went from a 20% market share to a 45% market share. Has nothing to do with the prices we were paying ACS to lease their network. Has to do with the fact that they raised their rates in the face of competition. But Kodiak customers don't have competitive choice. And when you deregulate a telephone company, you deregulate them for all of these communities where there is no competition. And so what you're doing is you're raising rates throughout Alaska where there is no competition and there is no competitive choice.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tindall.
Any other questions regarding this section four for Ms. Tindall?
Just, Mr. Chairman, thank you. What's your market share for GCI statewide? Because I assume that Anchorage has 60% of the customers, we've got 60% of the phones. So if you're 50-50 there, you're at
20%.
20% statewide.
If you were on K, do you want to go then to L?
Yeah. I'm an economist by training. I get passionate about this
experts,
stuff.
So understanding,
nobody gets passionate
all
about
in
terms of depreciation. Nobody gets passionate about depreciation.
Economists are terrible. Yeah. Okay.
An accountant.
My husband's an accountant.
What would you refer to the continual tomato analogies throughout the section?
You like that? Okay. Okay.
I started.
That's my fault. I'm sorry.
this goes back to the issue of setting unbundled network elements and rates. And the issue is, let me make sure that's what this does. Yeah, this goes to setting unbundled network element rates. The FCC has regulations saying that the rates that ACS or any other incumbent tomato grower will charge the new competitor shall be those forward-looking long-run incremental cost rates. And that is so that the new competitor coming in is indifferent between building its own network and leasing the costs from the incumbent company. Okay? Long-run incremental, long-run by its very nature, means that we are dealing with a hypothetical where you're assuming that you have the most advanced technology at the lowest cost. Okay? The FCC has regulated that for all states. It is a requirement for the states to follow. That has been taken all the way to the United States Supreme Court and upheld as a fair and reasonable way of setting rates for unbundled network elements. Now, the latitude that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska has is in choosing the models and in arbitrating the inputs that go into the models that set those rates. This section L